title of the forum tonight is Art or Obscenity, Christian Views on Censorship in the Arts. My name is Dan Spencer. I'm one of the summer program coordinators here and want to welcome you all tonight. This topic emerged in one of the teaching staff gatherings when several of the teaching staff were talking about what areas they're involved in. And Michael was saying that with his involvement in the arts, this might be an interesting topic. It's been much in the news with the National Endowment for the Arts and talking with some of the family issues that have been emerging in the village the last few days. We thought it might be interesting to gather folks and present a panel to get the conversation rolling. So we've got three folks up here, and I will moderate. Michael Arndt, who's one of our artists in residence here in the village and helping us especially with the Renaissance Day, is going to begin the forum and talk a little bit from an artist perspective, what are some of the issues. Heidi Schneider is a lawyer and also a person with a lot of experience in drama. We'll address some of the legal issues around the question of censorship in the arts. And Kathy Blomker agreed to present a parent's perspective on how some of these issues affect family life and some of the parenting issues. We put up a few of the different types of things that touch on this issue, the National Endowment for the Arts, some of the controversy about lyrics and rock music, violence in the media, the rather infamous or famous Mapplethorpe exhibit now that had the correct title is Piss Christ, but the image of Christ in urine, and the kind of controversy that evokes. So many of these, as well as a host of others that are brought up, or have to do with the issue of censorship and the arts. And one person's art is another person's pornography, those kinds of issues. So with that introduction, I think I'll let Michael begin. Our goal is to have each of the panelists speak for 3 or 4 minutes so that we have the bulk of the time for our community discussion. And we welcome all of your perspectives and viewpoints.
I initiated a discussion of this issue because I think it's an issue that suits a forum, and especially as an artist, I'm very much concerned about this issue. I teach at California Lutheran University, which is a small liberal arts college affiliated with the Lutheran Church in Southern California. And it's an issue that I deal with on a regular basis and have dealt with some real struggles. Struggles both in myself in terms of plays that I present and also with students who are asking, can we do such and such a play on the campus at a Lutheran school? I have done plays that have been controversial. I'm not afraid of controversy. I'm not afraid of plays with language or subject matter that stretches people's comfort zone a little bit, in some cases quite a bit. I've done plays that are heavily scatological. But I am concerned. I'm concerned with the sensibilities of the audience. This whole summer here at Holden is dedicated to the environment and what is happening to our environment, and is our environment becoming more and more polluted and corrupted that we're losing the basic essence of what it is to be a human being in touch with the rest of God's creation. In some ways the arts are suffering from the same kind of problem in some areas, because there are many people that feel that the arts are becoming polluted in the same way, as much, and that arts and culture really are as much a part of our environment as trees and sunshine and everything else. And so immediately the question arises, which I think is the overall question for tonight: how do you make decisions about whether something is obscene or whether something is art? The other question, which the basic issue calls to attention, and I hope Heidi addresses this as well, is when should government, or when should the people through their representatives, start making some decisions about art and artists. When should censorship come into play? And the big issue for most of those of us in the arts has been the National Endowment for the Arts. And a number of the amendments and impositions put on the funding of the National Endowment through the last Congress, and which is still being debated in front of Congress. To give you a little bit more perspective, and I don't want to take too much of the time, but just maybe a little bit of background about the National Endowment of the Arts. It was founded in 1965. And since 1965, it has had a budget each year which has been allocated to various arts groups throughout the country. And this money has been used by artists to fund exhibitions, by operation budgets of orchestras, theaters, and so forth. To give you some kind of perspective of this, over the last 25 years, due to the National Endowment for the Arts, orchestras have grown from 60 to 210 in the country. Dance companies, since 1965, professional dance companies have grown from 37 to 250. Nonprofit professional theaters have gone from 56, over 90% in New York, to 400, over 90% out of New York. The annual budget for the NEA last year was $171 million. To put that in kind of perspective, it's 0.02% of the federal budget. It represents 65 cents per taxpayer. And it's smaller than the line item in the defense budget for marching bands. The main focus of the National Endowment for the Arts is that it has been seed money. Because if a theater company or an orchestra or an artist receives a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, that usually authenticates that particular artist or arts group, and they usually are able to tap into corporate money and so forth. The statute says that the intent of this act should be the encouragement of free inquiry and expression. One of the artists' and humanists' greatest values to society is the mirror of self-examination they raise so that society can become aware of its shortcomings as well as its strength. Congress's statement, which has caused a lot of the controversy, includes the following: that no funded work may involve obscenity, including but not limited to depictions of sadomasochism, homoeroticism, the exploitation of children, or individuals engaged in sex acts. That's a little background. My one statement I'll make personally as an artist is that I don't think censorship from above, government censorship, or anybody telling an artist that the artist cannot do something is wise in any case. I think it's only because artists are allowed to explore the full range of their creativity that they are able to come up with the great works of art. They may come up with a lot of dreck, a lot of really bad art, but unless they're given total freedom to explore their particular art form, our culture will suffer.
Okay. Heidi, do you want to address some of the legal ramifications?
Well, I'll try. I came up here to Holden with a whole box full of books, and they included the complete works of Shakespeare and a number of files on adoption. And the thing that I didn't include were any of my legal textbooks. So what I have to say is I'm shooting from the hip tonight, and I hope that none of you take what I say as the law, because I could be wrong about it. But I did look up the First Amendment, and this is the real First Amendment to the Constitution. It says, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or the press, or the right of people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And I read the whole thing, even though perhaps the only portion that we're particularly interested in is that the Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, which has been interpreted quite broadly to mean expression generally. Because this whole amendment, generally, as you can tell, has something to do about religion and politics, or the right of people to assemble. It's kind of like the basis of democracy in some ways. So people who are absolutists about the First Amendment say that interpreting freedom of speech, you should allow, speech means anything, absolutely anything goes, and that's kind of the position that Michael is saying with regard to allowing artists to express what they want to express. On the other hand, people who interpret the Constitution much more narrowly look at this and say, well, what the founders who wrote the Constitution had in mind really was just political speech, and if you look at the context of this particular phrase, abridging the freedom of speech, it's within the context of the right of people to assemble peaceably and to petition the government for redress, and it's connected with the right of the press. And so they look at it much, much more narrowly. Those are kind of two ends of the spectrum. But generally what has happened is the courts and the legislatures have kind of come down in the middle of that, saying that some regulation of speech is okay, or some regulation of expression is okay, and some and so that's, I think, really where we fall here. Generally, commercial, what is called commercial speech, is rather heavily regulated. And just an example of that would be if your metropolitan bus system, whether to run an ad on the metropolitan bus system about condoms, for instance, I think was a case that came up recently, whether it's okay to have advertisements for condoms on a bus, and whether that is proper or not is the kind of thing that generally can be regulated, and because it's an advertisement, that sort of thing can be regulated. So you're probably not going to find too many condom advertisements on a bus. On the other hand, courts tend to take political speech very, very seriously, and they will not allow any restrictions on any kind of political type of speech. And the case that I can think of most recently in the last couple of years was a march in Illinois, I believe, of Nazis who wanted to march in a Jewish community. And that also has the right of people peaceably to assemble, but the element of freedom of speech was also there. And as I recall, they were allowed to do that, so because it was considered a political statement, and that's given a great deal of leeway. So you come down to the question of pornography, and this is what the court, and particularly the Supreme Court, has really struggled with. And the court has not been able to define what it is, what obscene means. And I think all of us maybe would be happy if the Supreme Court came down and had a definition of what something means when it's obscene, because then it would be easy to knock this out and include this in. But the court has really avoided defining what obscenity is. You've probably heard the famous line by one of the justices, and I can't remember his name right now, who said, "I know it when I see it." And that's about as close as they've gotten in some sense. As I recall, it seems like the one area that is quite clearly delineated as obscene has to do with what we would call child pornography, and I think that that's defined as sexually explicit materials depicting children. And that is not considered to be speech that one can freely, or expression that one can freely express. It is legislated, and it is not permitted. The other thing that I recall from taking the bar exam, I believe, is that the standard used by courts to decide if something is obscene or not is based on a community standard. So, in other words, if you live in Duluth, Minnesota, I don't mean to put anyone down in Duluth, the community standard regarding obscenity is probably going to be quite different than Los Angeles, California. And that is also another way the courts have kind of gotten around defining obscenity, because they say, well, obscenity is kind of in the eye of the community. I guess, and most of the First Amendment cases are those that do go to juries, so you'll have a community of people deciding that.
Thanks, Heidi. Kathy?
I don't have my notepad and notes. as a parent, and many of you I know are parents, and you think about this all the time, what do I want my kids exposed to? What can I control about what my kids are exposed to? And just as some examples, some little vignettes pop into my mind. One of my jobs is working with teenagers, and they happen to be adjudicated minors. And we do, it's an adventure challenge group, so one of the things that we do is we go on a wilderness expedition, and we were hiking along one day, and I was listening to this rap song and kind of, you know, grooving, and then I started listening to the words, and it was about this guy who took the sheriff's daughter out on a date and chopped her up with a machete. And I think this is obscene, and I, you know, I confronted the kid, but as a parent, you know, I can watch the movies that my kids see, but I don't know what's going in his ears with you know, earphones and a little tape thing. I don't know what he's listening to. And I truly believe that these things, when they are repeated and repeated and repeated, make an impact, especially violence. Another little vignette I think of is thinking about two movies, both of which are rated R. And one is The Blues Brothers, some of you may have seen, and I really don't know why it was rated R. One is Nightmare on Elm Street, which I haven't seen but I've heard about all the time. And part of it is because this, it's called Sprite. Sprite is a month-long program, and I've worked for 2.5 years or so. So every single group that I've worked with of these kids, boys, girls, city kids, country kids, somebody brings up Freddy. We do things at the Sprite house where we sleep inside. We do high ropes, low ropes, and so forth. The first time we go into the woods, we go camping, rock climbing. First time we go into tents and it's dark out, Freddy comes up. Someone's terrified of the dark because of this idiot movie. I think that's obscene. And I've told my kids I don't want them to see it. I had an experience this spring where my oldest, I don't know if he's here or not, he's in just finished fifth grade, was invited to a class party. The mother of one of the girls invited the whole class to an end of school party, first party. So I thought, well, gee, that sounds like a good kind of party to go to. All the fifth grade kids will be there and the parents will be there and so forth. And so I sent him on his way, and it was sometime later, probably 2 weeks, and I found out that during part of the party, my son and his friend, one friend out of the whole class, had spent part of the party outdoors because Nightmare on Elm Street was on the VCR. And all these kids were watching this movie, and mine was felt that he was told not to, and so he didn't. That doesn't always happen. I was surprised it did this time, but he was therefore excluded from the companionship of his friends. I think that there are a lot of things that children are not developmentally prepared to process safely, that that things that come with maturity, that as adults we can process, children don't have the developmental tools. And I don't, as far as censorship, I have this one picture of all these unknown horrors going into my children's ears, but I have this other vivid mental picture of book burning. And I'm wondering where in the continuum is an appropriate place, and I don't know the answer.
Thanks, Kathy. As we turn now to open it up to the broad community, let me just mention another thing about the Holden Forums. The forums are set up here as a chance for us all to get our viewpoints out without any expectation to arrive at consensus or some resolution of the issue. Particularly on the one tonight, I want to stress that. What we are looking for is hearing from all of us and to get a variety of viewpoints. We encourage lively discussion. Oftentimes that leads to strong disagreement, but there is no need to feel any pressure to try and resolve this issue, and we certainly don't want people to hold back on their perspectives or viewpoints because it may be in disagreement with someone else's. So encourage you, whatever your viewpoint is or perspective. We've had opportunities to hear a viewpoint from an artist, some of the legal ramifications, and how you might think about how you would decide. Were you in a position to decide the legal barriers or boundaries to the issue? And also some of the family issues that come in, both from a parenting perspective. We would be delightful to hear from some other members of families what it's like to be a teenager, perhaps, and these issues coming up. So at this point, we turn it over to you.
It seems to me that there's a big difference between censorship and saying we won't pay for something, or we will not rule that the taxpayer has to pay for it. I think that whenever you have purchase or an award or some kind of financial underwriting of something, there's a selection process that goes on. And I don't understand why, when a committee looks at the art or whatever it is that they're deciding whether or not to spend the money on, that's a selection process, but when the public gets involved, it's censorship.
If I could just respond to that, I think the difference comes through legislation. When legislation becomes involved, or it becomes a law, as in the case of the NEA, statements was written in to all applications for grants this past year, in which artists had to say they would not, in applying for the arts grant, they would in no way do anything obscene according to the definitions. And many artists who never, and their organizations have never done anything that could be either legally or conjecturally labeled as obscene, rejected the money from the NEA instead of signing this particular statement. And that statement currently is being under advisement by the chairman of the NEA, John Trumeyer, because these groups, and many of them are prominent groups throughout the country in New York, Los Angeles, and so forth, really felt very strongly whether they personally would do it or not, that if it's a legislated from the top kind of statement, that does become censorship, and I think we become involved in the issue, as Dan pointed, or as Kathy pointed out. When do you get what is the line? And as I said earlier, I'm personally really concerned too, because I think there's really a lot of bad stuff out there, and I'm about to become a father, and I'm worried about it too in the future if we keep moving this direction.
But none of this legislation is saying they can't produce it, right? All it's saying is that we won't buy it.
But where does that start? Does that start at the grassroots, or does it start from the government on down?
I think her point is valid. The First Amendment First Amendment is pretty specific, and in most cases, it's pretty broadly interpreted. But there's a big difference, and you're mixing the concepts here by saying that the First Amendment protects something, and then taking the leap to say that the government therefore must fund it. As far as saying that there's a problem and people have conscientious objections to signing documents, if there are farmers in this room, you sign documents when you apply for price supports, and you make certain representations in those documents that you won't plant any more acreage than you promised, or you won't plant this acreage to corn when you say you're going to plant it to wheat. You know, but the point still is, that's your right. If you want the government money, you play by the government rules. You're not being stopped as an artist, and I think that's her point, from producing the kind of art that you want. The question, if this forum is truly about what is obscenity, then that's one focus. That's more of a First Amendment focus. And then we get into the parents' interests and the legal interests and the community's interests and the private school's interests and the church's interests. If the question is who's going to pay for it, that's a different question. Because each of you is in a church, and I'll bet you folks that there are things that you would not put up in your churches under the rubric of protective art. And you, therefore, are engaging in censorship. But you would defend to the death your right and the right of any other church to do that, wouldn't you? And you, as an artist, wouldn't expect to walk into a church in another community and say, even though you may think this is obscene, yeah, we're done. So I think, you know, we're mixing the concepts here. Who's going to fund it? Is it obscene? They're difficult things to talk about, but I think the point is, just because you're not being paid for it doesn't mean that you're being censored instead of producing.
Jeff, can you do it?
Yeah, I think I do. I think it's disingenuous to say that if we don't fund it, they're still allowed to do it, because I think there are artists out there who, if they don't get funding of some sort, simply can't do it, and the people who do the funding know that. So it is a way of stopping the production of that kind of art. Maybe they're free to think up concepts in their head, as we all are, but we aren't able to act them out without some kind of backing and some kind of funding. And this is a real prestigious kind of backing and funding. The second and only other thing I want to say is that your comparison to farm supports is real interesting and makes real good sense, because what it points out is that whenever we're giving money away, whenever anybody's giving money away, we have what we call criteria. And I think the real focus of our discussion tonight is, how do we decide these particular criteria for this particular kind of money, if you want to just focus on the NEA, the funding of this kind of stuff. And I think these criteria are, this might just be stupid, you know, probably all figure this out, but the criteria for what kind of farming is good farming are probably a lot less controversial than what kind of art is good and acceptable art. So, how's that?
The issue actually does go beyond just funding as well. There have been entire exhibits that galleries have refused to show in New York, for example, because they were scared that pieces would go against even not being funded by the NEA, but would go against what they felt was appropriate, and the galleries would actually not show those exhibits. So it does go beyond just the funding of it.
It's not the money. I think that's the tough issue, because one of the reasons I gave that all those statistics early at the beginning, the money is really infinitesimal. It's just what the NEA means to a lot of artists, and I agree that a lot of artists could not exist without some kind of stamp on their work or their continuance in their art. That's one of the issues.
The other side of the money thing is that I don't know if many of you have read some of the latest rock lyrics. A lot of them you have to read because you can't understand them when you hear them. But they're really awful, just awful. But some of these groups that are so wealthy that they can produce their own music and do their own distribution. So the NEA really doesn't have anything to do with a lot of the things that we look at as should this be censored or not.
I have a concern about the censorship involved with the NEA. Just taking a hypothetical situation concerning the gentleman who unfortunately has died, who had created Piss Christ. Hypothetically, he saw all of this controversy around this, and he realized that he could never again get NEA funding if he continued with the same sort of topics. And so he decided to do landscape photography. He went out into middle America and took pictures of dying America. He took beautiful pictures of fences and trees and things, and he presented these to the NEA, and they turned him down because one, and the third one was of an old wire fence. Well, that's obviously sadomasochistic because we know the kind of stuff this guy does. And that's the reason that I have some real problems with this NEA censorship issue.
You should read that little review in case people don't know.
Yeah, and there are two different artists here involved. This is Robert Mapplethorpe, who is a photographer, and his, and it's not the same gentleman. Soranto did Piss Christ. Robert Mapplethorpe's photography received a lot of controversy because it depicted males kissing and a lot of homosexual art among all kinds of other pictures. It was just a few pictures that were controversial. And this is really important to point out, too, that usually the stories that everybody hears are just a small representation of the general work of the individual artists.
It's interesting. I was in D.C. last summer, and that was when Robert Mapplethorpe's exhibit was canceled. They refused to fund it, and it got canceled out of its gallery. And a group of the artist community in D.C. got together, and with all volunteer labor and with a volunteer gallery, they put on the exhibit after moving it in the course of like 48 hours or something. Anyways, but they put on his exhibit, and it was reviewed, and I unfortunately didn't get to go see it. But it's interesting, your story, and then what he says, because the way they set it up, they had the offensive pictures, they had separated in a little area sort of in the back where they told you, you know, these were offensive, you don't have to go in here.
Did they say offensive?
I don't remember what they said exactly, but they told you, this is where the pictures you read about are. And actually, the rest, he does, or the pictures that they had, I can't remember what the first series was, but the second series was actually flowers. He takes pictures of flowers. And some of them are supposed to be very erotic flowers. Because when you think about it, flowers is a sex organ. But anyways, so we're smelling now. So what you say isn't at all outlandish, because this particular artist has been interpreted that way. Somebody could say they didn't even want his flower photographs because of that sort of interpretation. My feeling is that he's saying with the NEA being so influential and also the money being so minuscule, and in addition, the art that it's funding is usually not blaring out in public, and so similar to this section was labeled, you don't have to go in here, this is the bad stuff. By them giving them money, all they're doing is basically allowing them to make this art, and I don't think that refusing to allow people to make stuff, because even though I'm never going to go see it, it's bad, is a very good policy at all.
Well, you're still looking at that, Mike. I think the point you raised, Kathy, is a very interesting one in terms of the intersection between economics and art, and then setting either censorship or guidelines on that, because it, as you brought up in the case, there are certain folks who are wealthy enough they can bypass any kind of a government regulation of it because they simply have enough money themselves, versus folks who don't are now having to go through government channels and some sort of guidelines, at least, whether it was about censorship. And that does raise some interesting questions about who can produce art and who has the resources to do it and how does it get regulated.
I have this quotation, and I'll just, this is from the September-October 1990 copy of the Utney Reader. It's an article from the St. Paul Pioneer Press, those of you from Minnesota. What is obscenity? Aside from the homoerotic photographs of Robert Mapplethorpe, the most controversial NEA-financed work was sculptor Andre Serrano's small wooden crucifix in a plexiglass tank filled with urine. His title, Piss Christ, prompted cries of blasphemy. But take away the title, and what do we have? The crucified Christ floats in a deep golden rosy glow, both ominous and glorious. A few bubbles wafting across the surface suggest a nebula, is how art critic Lucy Lippard described it. Serrano used the shocking title for a purpose. I consider myself a Christian, and I practice my faith through my work, he says. I use bodily fluids because they're life's vital fluids. They appeal to me visually, and they're symbolically charged with meaning. A Catholic church that invites the devout to symbolically partake of Christ's body and blood every Sunday should understand Serrano's point. Now, this obviously was a very poignant article, but it's a quotation.
So, I think we've kind of focused primarily on the NEA and that issue. I think Kathy's concern as a parent, and be more along the lines that I'd like to focus on a bit. I become concerned about how I as a parent can influence or at least be aware of what are the things that my children are being exposed to. And also I become concerned with much of what is in so-called entertainment today portrays that it's okay to, you know, violence towards women is okay. Exploitation of a variety of sorts, degrading masculine types, all of these are okay. Not only okay, but they are encouraged. And one of the concerns that a lot of sociologists, anthropologists, and other religious types are concerned about, how do we, as a society, enable people to do what is called species bonding, to where we identify ourselves with our species, the common human community, rather than all of these forms that are so prevalent that are degrading human beings. And that's a real concern for me. I don't know how we do it if everything is valueless. As a society, we do state that some things are values, and if there are no regulations, then even the one thing that we've identified today, supposedly agreed upon, where showing children in erotic sexual scenes is, you know, why eliminate that? Because that's free expression.
Haven't we completely forgotten, as far as I know the parent hasn't, but we need to remember that our bodies are a temple of the Holy Spirit, and anything that takes us away from that, you're corrupting your youth, and I think that's what the parent is taking about, and I think we need to think about that. We're only thinking about what's law or not. As parents, we have to think about what's purely moral in a Christian setting.
I took a class called Children in Television a couple of years ago in college, and I was trying to remember the numbers, but something like there's 41 acts of significant violence per hour And significant violence would be a heavy assault, you know. When you see someone being shot, well, the body is, temple has been severely violated. So what I'm saying is it's out there, and it seems odd that we will get really worked up in the media every couple of years over something sexual. Censorship will come down over some sex will be the main thing. And I think one of the main problems that we have is that we have just all kinds of violence in our society. And in this class, some of the things they showed us that the researcher taped off of cable TV during the daytime would just, you couldn't believe that this kind of stuff was being shown. And the number of families that have paid for cable and several television sets around is just amazing. So our children are being exposed. We are being exposed to awful, awful acts of violence and obscenity all the time. And I don't know what the answer is, but I think it's something that we live with, and that very hard to make laws and start pointing down what is obscene when we're really surrounded by violence and obscenity. And I just don't see who really has the right to say what the community standards are. It's usually, and when you see it happening around the country, the communities that start banning books and doing this and that, it's usually very well-intentioned but misguided. And people, it seems to me, people end up getting hurt more.
Something in response to this and everything else, I'm thinking about people's motives and censorship and all, and TV brought this to mind. Something that I get really bothered by TV commercials and programs and things, and I think what bothers me the most is that it's the cheapness of it, the motive of the person who is, or of the people producing whatever the commercial is to make money, and whereas the motive of the man who did Piss Christ wasn't necessarily make money. It was a form of expression for maybe truth or meaning. I don't know him or the work of art, but my bias about art is that's the case. The motive is an expression of truth or meaning, and my prejudice about media or an interpretation of media is this is money making. And it doesn't take much for me to consider that obscene, the media. And I'm a lot more lenient with a person's attempts for expression of meaning or truth or however you want to express that. For me, that there's a huge difference there. The person's motive makes a big difference, I think. And I think there's a lot of trash, too, in a person's sincere attempts to make authentic expressions of the human spirit or whatever, and there's a problem with that too. But I'm just saying that I would tend to be a lot more open-minded about that than I am about a person's motive to make money.
So. I was having similar thoughts to that just sitting here, because I discovered that even though I maintain the same kind of line that Michael was saying, that all censorship has got to be seriously questioned and opposed, and that we do need to fund artists somehow. And so I want to take a strong anti-censorship stand, and yet I would have to admit that I have some strong censorship tendencies, and I found them coming up, probably all of us can relate to that. I was finding them coming out when it came to television. I was thinking of television. And we all try to justify our own exceptions. And so this is my attempt to justify my exception. I may not be convincing myself. The difference I see where television and, say, radio come in is that they are public airwaves, and there's a difference between actively going to an art gallery or a museum or buying a book, etc., and something that comes at us over public domain. We can say that there's an on and off switch on our TVs, but I think that's only true to an extent. I think it's basically a cop-out that the networks have used, because those airways belong, by law, to the public. They do not belong to NBC, CBS, or Fox. They're our property, and these are corporate profit agencies using something that belongs to me, you know, the airways, which is a very powerful thing. The other part of that is the technology involved. The television as a medium is a very hypnotic thing, and it affects me in ways that I'm not aware of. It affects the brain waves in ways that looking at a painting or even looking at a movie, you know, does not. Just the nature of the light emanating from the screen has a hypnotic effect. I suppose that rap music has had that accusation too, that it's very hypnotic, the style of its music. And yet there I have a choice whether to buy it for the most part or not. So there's my justification for maintaining an anti-censorship stand with allowing some of my hesitations to come through.
Is there a hand in the balcony?
Yeah. I don't know about the second. I agree with the second part of your justification, which that television is kind of an evil thing, and you know, you're probably right. I have no doubt that it is. But you know, I mean, we do have the option either to turn the television or the radio off. Plus, we do have the option not to buy a television or not to buy a radio if we so choose. Plus, if you want to take that argument that the airwaves are public domain, I mean, I think you can go the same way with the paper that your books are printed on come from trees, which are probably on government land in the end. So, I don't know. It just, that seems to be kind of fuzzy to me, and there's enough room for rejection. It's not like any of this is going to be forced upon us, because we do have that choice. And if it turns out that there's a specific cable channel that is broadcasting really nasty things, you know, we just, you know, don't look at that channel if you don't want to. I don't know. I don't agree with the first part of your question.
There's also just a point of rejection also, that you don't have to buy the product that is supporting the program.
Well, there is a difference. There's an actual difference, I'll still argue for, between buying a tape and turning on and off a television set. Mm-hmm. I'll try to come up with an analogy here. The mass introduction of alcohol to Native American populations, which, because of the nature of alcoholism, addicted some people to alcohol. I mean, we can say that something ethically was wrong about that, and that person suddenly addicted, whose body is now dependent upon alcohol, has been unfairly treated, even though he has the decision as a choice in the first place to buy the alcohol or not. Still, when your body becomes addicted to it, you have less of a choice. You need help in overcoming that. Television, I would argue, is the same way. For some people more than others, the same as alcohol, it is addictive. It does something to you. It affects your body in a way that a photograph in an art gallery will not.
I guess I would say that there are personalities that may have addictive tendencies. Those who are addicted to violent rock music will go out and buy rock music tapes as easily as they will turn off and on the television. I know that's true. Or steal them. I mean, that's the kids I'm used to working with.
It's okay to say that we can turn off our TVs and radios, but don't we as Christians have some responsibility towards other people besides our own families, other children?
I think we do.
Should we be influencing something?
It seems to me that we're on kind of dangerous ground when you start. I think you're right that we do. I mean, we do have responsibility from our direct actions toward the people around us. But when that comes to regulating the actions of other people to an extent where you're saying, you know, we may as well say, because we are Christians and because of our religion, we feel that swearing is very harmful. Then we have a moral responsibility to outlaw all foul language. And, you know, it seems to me whenever you use that justification, you're just setting the precedent that says that, you know, it's okay to legislate our Christian morals into law, which probably isn't that good of an idea.
Here, and then we'll come over here.
I don't think we have to outlaw so much as we cannot support certain types of things that we all know are not good for us or good for anybody else for that matter, without really censoring it or stopping people from creating it. Kathy was saying don't buy a product, don't support a network. Those things work. They get the message. People don't want it. And it eliminates itself in some cases.
Jan, and then Dick, and then Jim.
This is not an opinion so much as, well, it may come out sounding like one. Just wanted to invite everybody to come into the Resource Center tomorrow to read a little book I've got in there. It's not a little book. It's about this size and about this thick, listing all the books that have been banned or in other ways regulated or tried to be excluded from the societies from which they were. They emerged over the centuries. It makes very interesting reading.
I think one of the real gifts of the community of artists in any society is that they help us see ourselves. And when that's done within a sense of free expression, it's been a healing agent for societies. We've seen in the Eastern Bloc countries when that hasn't happened, you know, how harmful that's been. And one of the things I think we're failing to recognize here is that an artistic community is helping us to see ourselves in this society, and quite frankly, it's a reflection on us if we as a consumptive society are willing to purchase these sorts of products. And the real issue isn't so much what the artistic community is doing, but what they are trying to help us see about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And are we then willing to come to grips with the final, you know, with way, what they are helping us to see? And I think in a sense, we really avoided that issue in our discussion. And I think we need to deal with that.
There is a real difference between that issue seemed to be identified in some of our discussion on the NEA and what it will fund. The difference between that and the bombarding that we get from the entertainment industry and so forth, where I can't fully regulate by turning on what comes across my TV. I mean, a lot of times my kids are watching, I don't have the time to sit and watch everything that they do. Or I'm sitting there and get bombarded by a commercial where, you know, just relaxing for a minute, and it's there before, you know, maybe you all have remotes. I don't have one. I can turn it off that quickly, you know. I mean, it's, or I'm going to daze myself, that hypnotic thing. I mean, it's just the issue between the artistic expression, I think we want our artists to challenge our sensibilities and open our horizons. On the other hand, that's been the excuse for pornography as well. You know, they used to call them in Minneapolis Astor Arts, movie theater when they had the stuff down there, XXX. It was art.
I was just a comment before I give to Jeff, but I was the question of the pervasiveness of it and how much you can regulate. That was really brought home to me when I was talking with a friend of mine where they've raised their children with no television and no guns and nothing, you know, really trying to inculcate what they would consider to be important values to them. And at the first week of their child attending daycare, the three-year-old came over home to them and said to the mother, "I hate you, I shoot you." And this was after 1 week of interacting with peers. And so it's a, I think the point being that even if we can try and regulate our individual behavior, we live in a communal society, and these values are out there. And your point, Dick, about this being a judgment on our own society, I think there's some basis to that. Jeff?
I want to focus this. It seems like there's one segment of the Christian community that wants to change. To me, a real important issue for us here, we seem to share a real common batch of intentions. We want artists to be able to create and to be supported in that and not have to be, you know, way dry. We want our kids to be able to see the good and not have to be exposed to the bad. And it just seems to come down to, how do we achieve that? And one of the things I teach is argument. And it seems like there's one segment of the Christian population that thinks if we could just legislate all these things, then people's minds would be changed, society would be good, families would be strong, you know, everybody would be happy, we'd all be eating chicken. And there's another segment of the population where I would put this kind of place that it seems to work from below. And I'm starting to hear comments now from us about, you know, this is a reflection on our society, and we are doing these things. And like you said, you don't have time to sit down and watch all the things your kids watch. But I think we're being real simplistic about how do we deal with this. It's not whether they're exposed to it, or whether we're exposed to it, or whether we're not exposed to it. It's we can be exposed to it, and it doesn't have an irrevocable effect, I don't think. And that what we're really doing is defending a lifestyle where we're letting all of this stuff, I keep using the words our kids, even though I don't have any, you have to realize I'm not speaking from experience here. But that we talk about, we're letting our kids be exposed to all this stuff, and then we're not taking the time to then try and help them see this stuff in a different light. And, you know, granted, kids don't always want to benefit from parental experience, but we are, in effect, defending a lifestyle that a lot of us find reprehensible. You know, I hate you, I shoot you. That's all. I just want to move it from, you know, should the government be censoring, to what are some other ways of trying to achieve this and maybe more effectively.
We've got time for one or two more comments. I see a couple of people who haven't spoken yet, and we'll need to wrap that
up. I just have a quick one that totally agrees with Jeff, and that you can use the Simpsons, Two Live Crew, whatever, to speak with your children about these issues. I mean, it's as well, while doing that, though, working on the roots of society and changing that discrimination of women in advertising is one that repulses me. And, you know, not buying products is one way to rectify that a bit, but there's more that has to be done, and it's not just censoring, it's metamorphosizing society. But at the same time, you can use what's happening around us as discussion points.
Juba,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It kind of goes along with what she's saying. I have learned and I have found out that it doesn't help to provide censorship for your own children. We can try as much as we can as parents to protect them from those evils out there. But to allow them some choices for themselves, be it music or whatever, and at least try to be aware of what they're doing, what they're listening to, so that you can discuss it, or so that you can at least share that that's not your viewpoint. I think it's more important for them to know that that's not what you feel is a proper value than to say, no, I don't want you to listen to that, or no, you may not watch that. And then, of course, they're going to want to watch it or listen to it to find out what's so terrible.
I still maintain, though, that there is a young age at which they are not able to make responsible decisions. I mean, it is our privilege and obligation to do that.
And I was talking more about teens when they're beyond the point where you can watch them every moment. They're 16, 17, 18, 19, and they're gone. And by then, you hope that they have proper values of their own to make the right choice.
We're at that point of a forum that's moderated as Dilemma and Delight, that we're out of time, and I still see lots of hands. I would just comment that we see forums and holding this conversation starters, not the final word. So I encourage you to take what's been spoken tonight, what's not been had a chance to be spoken, and take it to a coffee break or on to further conversations. But thank you all for coming tonight. Thank our panelists for providing the grounding for the conversations.